May be seated. Thank you. Before we start our third argument of the day, I want to welcome, I understand we just had the fourth graders from Pinedale Elementary are joining us, and I want to welcome that class to the argument here this morning. The third argument scheduled for this morning is State of South Dakota versus Jacqueline Krause. We have Sean Nichols here, who on behalf of the defendant and appellant will be arguing, and Stephen Guimar will be arguing for Appley State of South Dakota. Each side will have 20 minutes for your argument, and then Mr. Nichols, you will have a 10-minute rebuttal. The warning light will come on at 2 minutes to give you a little indication of when you're getting close toward the end. So, Mr. Nichols, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. We are here on an appeal, matter of State versus Jackie Krause. This is an appeal from a March 19, 2021 conviction of arson in the second degree with intent to collect insurance. I believe the statute is of first impression, at least as far as the insurance is concerned, in its current iteration. Before getting into the case, I think it's important to note that we have viewed the statute as a specific intent statute. This court in 2015 in State versus Rosales in paragraph 9, the dicta appeared to indicate that this court also viewed 2233(9)(2) as a specific intent statute. And lastly, the trial court did treat it as a specific intent statute. I think that's important. I didn't want to gloss that fact over because although this court has frequently noted a reluctance to disturb the finding of a lower court, as a matter of fact, when it comes to specific intent, this court has repeatedly held that that means something and has not hesitated to hold that higher evidentiary bar to matters of specific intent. In the last 10 years alone, in matters of sexual contact, where there was no evidence of intent to obtain gratification or arousal, a number of cases involving contractors with intent to defraud or deceive by pocketing money and walking off of a job, to a second-degree kidnapping case in 2016, and as well as a attempted infant homicide case in 2015, this court has repeatedly held that specific intent must mean something. And if there isn't evidence in the record at the trial court to support that outcome, this court will reverse. The facts of this case stem from a fire that occurred on March 13, 2019 in Lincoln County at the home of Jackie Krause. Prior to the fire, Jackie was living in the home by herself. She had intended to sell the home as her daughter was in college and her oldest son was a senior in high school living with her father, didn't need the space, intended to downsize. Prior to listing the home for sale, she had the house pre-inspected to determine what issues may have been needed to address before putting the house on the market. The home inspection was fairly benign in terms of finding little things, punch list things that needed to be improved, but no mechanical or foundational issues of note. In addition to some of the things in the report, Ms. Krause was also actively having painters and some other people address the punch list stuff in the house shortly before the fire. There was also some indication that she was working on some staining projects in the basement as she's an artist at the time of the fire. When the fire occurred on the night of the 13th, the Sioux Falls Police Department, Fire and Rescue Department inspected the fire. They noted nothing remarkable about the burn pattern. They noted no evidence of accelerant used. And their ultimate conclusion in the report, which is in Exhibit 102, 103, and 104, and the record was that it was an accidental fire, the source of combustion unknown. And that is where the criminal piece of this begins and ends as far as law enforcement is concerned. A few days later, the following day, Ms. Krause, as any homeowner would, put State Farm on notice of the loss and State Farm then came to her home. And after two individuals in their claims investigation department went through the home, they flagged some things that in their mind they considered red flags. Those would be that the house was going to be listed for sale on the market, that there was some repair work being done in the house with the painters. And one of the investigators also had indicated that she felt that there was some evidence of large unpaid bills. She was rifling through Ms. Krause's personal effects, which I'll get to later. There was no real evidence of that at the trial. But from there, they decided to have their own fire inspection conducted, and a fire investigator hired by State Farm thereafter went through the home and retrieved a security camera. And he felt in the footage, it showed Ms. Krause holding a box of matches in the only interior camera in the 5,000 square foot home, and that he felt that there was a striking motion in the box before she went into a mechanical room where the fire was believed to have started. From there, the ball gets rolling. Mr. Blumseth contacts the fire department and advises them of what he's found on this video, that there's in fact evidence of Ms. Krause igniting the fire. And from there, she was charged with second degree arson. Those are the facts that were largely presented at trial. We assert there are three grounds for error for the trial court determining that Ms. Krause was guilty. Our first is that, as I had indicated, there was a motion for judgment of acquittal after the case. State rested, and there just was no evidence of either specific intent to or intent to cause a fire, and certainly no evidence of intent to commit or collect insurance money. Secondly, we assert as grounds for error the fact that the trial court issued findings of fact in rendering a decision in this case, and based on South Dakota Supreme Court's decision in 2014 in Nicolet, that those facts are binding for appellate purposes, and those facts included no finding of specific intent to collect the insurance money. And lastly, we assert as grounds for error the fact that the investigation in this case was conducted largely by the victim. The victim was the investigator and the expert witness at trial, and based on how this trial was conducted, there was absolutely none of the hallmarks that you would expect in a criminal case. Or criminal protections, procedural protections, as State Farm essentially functioned as the party filling in the shoes of the state, not bound by any of the constitutional protections. And as a result, we believe that this trial was fundamentally unfair to Ms. Krause. I want to address issue number one first. And before talking specifically about the cause of the fire, I think it's important. This is a two-element statute. There must be proof both of specific intent to cause the fire and specific intent to collect insurance. The index in this case has all of the exhibits that were introduced during a three-day trial. And remarkably, there isn't one piece of document that has anything to do with her insurance policy. In a case of specific intent involving insurance, the policy isn't even introduced into evidence. There isn't any evidence in the record as to what insurance she had. To come to the conclusion that she intended to collect insurance to better herself, I think the fundamental question of intent has to stem from what did she stand to gain? There were two witnesses from State Farm that testified at trial. I'm quoting Julie Morolzi's testimony on page 61 of volume one of the record. And she was asked, why did State Farm get brought into all of this? Well, we were brought in because Jackie Krause or Krause had a State Farm policy for the home that sustained the fire. For the entire value of the home? Question. Answer, that I don't know. What do you mean by the entire value of the home? Sometimes, I guess, sometimes a home is, you know, repairable. Sometimes it's not.
Counsel, I guess I'm not sure I'm understanding your argument here, but whether or not she had coverage for a fire or whether or not a claim would be paid really isn't the issue, is it? It's whether or not she committed an act with the intent to try to obtain insurance proceeds.
I agree with that very much, Justice Devaney, and the important.
And sorry, just one point to that, and there's no dispute that she did in fact put in a claim.
Well, we don't even know what she put in. She put them on notice that her house had burned down, but there isn't any claims materials as to what she even requested. Did she request contents coverage, or what did she ask for? State Farm didn't put any evidence of that in. There isn't a single exhibit that explained what she was even asking for. And if we're talking about specific intent to collect insurance, I think the fundamental question is, well, what did she intend to collect? And there is nothing in the record to even support to even get out of the gate as what she intended to collect. And so I think that gets in to the specific intent piece of it.
As you know, Mr. Nichols, I'm sorry, please finish your response. I thought you were wrapping up.
No, I was moving on to the other portion.
I thought you might have been. So forgive me if I interrupted. But as you know, oftentimes in cases of intent, general intent or specific intent, the evidence comes indirectly through circumstances that might be presented in the evidence. And it's the rare case sometimes where there's actual direct evidence that demonstrates to a fact finder precisely what somebody meant. So I hear your argument, but are you placing too high of a premium upon the absence of direct evidence relating to specific intent? Because as you know, our standard review for specific intent offenses or general intent offenses is very deferential.
I'm glad you asked the question, Justice Salter, because I'm actually just moving to the circumstantial evidence of why she would do this in the first place. The argument from State Farm is that she potentially could be under financial duress because there was a pool bill observed by Julie Morolzi in the house for what she thought was $15,000 to $20,000 is what she testified to. It's on page 74, volume one. It turns out on Exhibit H that pool bill was $1,039, I think is what the actual amount was. Aside from that, there isn't any evidence in the record of financial duress at all. She was current on her mortgage. There was no other liens on the property. State Farm ran a credit check on her, apparently, and did not introduce that into evidence to suggest that there was some other financial duress. There was some testimony that was unsubstantiated about some past due bills. We don't know what those amounts were. They weren't put into evidence. The state called a financial auditor, and his transcript testimony covers 6 pages. And he testified over a 3-month period prior to the fire, Ms. Krause took in $118,000 and she spent $102,000. She had $16,000 of cushion over. So there was nothing in the circumstantial evidence of her money behavior in terms of bills, under duress, any ability to pay her mortgage. She was receiving $21,000 a month in alimony from her ex-husband, who was a surgeon. That is the evidence of her financial condition and how that gets transformed into an argument that she intended to collect the insurance money. And again, I don't want to belabor the point, but we don't even know what she stood to collect.
Counsel, it appeared, you know, in from my review of the trial record, that the primary argument that the state was making also had to do with the condition of the home on the evening in question and her finding water coming into the basement where the various renovations were occurring. And then there was testimony. You had indicated no foundational issues, but there was some testimony with regard to that came into trial.
Yes, there was water in the theater room that she observed moments before the fire occurred. To the extent of that, we don't know. It sounds like in Sioux Falls that day, other people were experiencing similar conditions because of ice flow and the weather pattern. But again, the water was not deep at all. This was an old garage that had been converted into a theater room, a core garage. And so the evidence of, you know, what this water damage may or may not have been and how significant it would have been really doesn't seem to move the meter. And I would note that Myra Olson for State Farm testified on page 109 of volume one. She had indicated the question was, well, how much was the value of this home? And she said to repair or to sell. And she said to sell was over $1 million. That was her view. And so you can't have it both ways, that this is, you know, some house that has all these problems. And then on the other hand, testify that this is $1 million home. There just isn't any reason in the transcript where Ms. Krause would have needed to start a fire when she's going to market this home. There isn't significant issues. There isn't anything in the record to say that she would have been better off committing arson and trying to make an insurance claim versus selling. State Farm's own testimony is that this house was over $1 million. And so I think that that is very important evidence in terms of intent. And again, getting to specific intent, this court has said it's got to mean something. Justice Devaney, your last opinion in Super in 2021, there was a contractor. I know that had taken money from three different people, and he was convicted of theft by deception by a contractor. And what this court had said, well, he may have been kind of a bad person and a poor money manager, but there wasn't anything in the record to suggest that he intended to, you know, take this money from people. We cited the Lau case from 2016, where an individual was convicted of second degree kidnapping, and this court reversed because he was too intoxicated to commit a specific intent crime.
But to accept your argument that the type of evidence that we have in this case just doesn't equate to a sufficient quantum of evidence to establish intent, specific intent, as you say. Don't we have to, first of all, to accept what you're saying, fail to commit, I guess, or depart from our well-settled standard, which requires us to accept the evidence in the light that's most favorable to the jury? One. Two, in a related way, as you parse the evidence, and your command of the record is wonderful, but does it depend upon relegating this piece of evidence to not, you know, insignificance and perhaps another one? And in this way, dividing and conquering individual components of the evidentiary record instead of, as I say, examining them in their totality, then applying our well-settled rule for reviewing sufficiency of the evidence, which kind of draws inferences in favor of the verdict.
Well, I would suggest to you that the record in its total, Your Honor, very much lacks any evidence of financial duress that would require her to commit this crime or give her a motive to commit this crime. And I was actually just going to move on to the piece of the fire itself, where you could call it picking or choosing, but there were three fire investigators that investigated this loss. And the only one that the trial court decided to accept in terms of his testimony was the expert hired by State Farm. But in terms of what the inspector for the city of Sioux Falls, the fire department, he couldn't rule out that spontaneous combustion was a cause of the fire. And again, as I had indicated, there was no evidence of accelerant used. If you look,
at least initially, he had that opinion. I'm not sure if that continued throughout the trial.
Well, but even his testimony was in Exhibit 77 would show, for example, that all the paint cans in this mechanical room still had their lids on them. So we are led to believe that Ms. Krause then would start a fire without the use of readily available accelerant. And so that's why I think the initial belief from the Sioux Falls Fire Department was that this was an undetermined cause of fire because of the burn patterns and lack of use of accelerant and things of that nature. I think it's important, and I wanted to stress this, a lot of what the trial court placed his decision on in finding conviction of guilt was his belief that this video showed Ms. Krause with the matchbox. The fire investigator was asked the specific what he thought of the box. And he said, I'm not able, this is on page 52 of volume one. I'm not able to identify it 100%. Question, okay, how about 90%? No, you can't. No, I mean, no. And even the expert for State Farm indicated that, his feeling that there was a striking motion on this box of matches before Ms. Krause went into the mechanical room to start the fire, there was no spark evident on that video. It's also, I think, highly relevant that there is no question that Ms. Krause was trying to suppress this fire. Even counsel in her closing arguments in this case believed, and I think the words were, well, she had regret. And that's how I guess they get from the idea that she started this fire and then thereafter was trying to suppress the fire, had to be removed, kicking and screaming physically from the house after her pets died with no shoes on in the middle of winter.
Well, counsel, though, the other evidence that the video shows is not just what happens when she enters the mechanical room. It's also her standing there. Well, the fact that no smoke is occurring until after she goes into that room. And then she stands there for quite a significant period of time, just simply watching as the smoke is coming out of the room and going back and forth a couple times before she goes upstairs. And the court made some findings and, sure, and some comments about that part of the video being very significant to the court as well.
Yes. And to address that specific question, I think that there was 25 seconds that she was standing by the door staring at the smoke. Prior to that, she was in this mechanical room for 2.5 minutes is what the state had indicated, thinking that maybe she's lighting matches, I guess, for 2.5 minutes to start a fire. The testimony that the defendants presented is, yes, as you had indicated, there was some water in the theater room. She was in there. This item she had in her hand was actually a flashlight. She was looking to see if there had been water penetration through the ceiling or where the source of the water was.
What testimony are you referring to there? There was some attempt to get some testimony in through her boyfriend who was in the home, right, with a hearsay objection that was sustained.
Yeah.
And so where in the evidence is there a testimony about her going into the theater room and looking for water and that sort of thing while she was
and
in
I
the
think that's
room.
Fair. That's probably more a construction from defense counsel, but there was testimony that she had a flashlight box that looked like a box of matches and that she would go into the theater room through the mechanical room from the boyfriend. But as to your question about the smoldering, Mr. Dahl, our expert in this case, had indicated that he thought this was a spontaneous combustion fire caused by stain rags and Officer Tejarda couldn't rule that out, and it said that he didn't know what the painters were doing that day. And so from my standpoint, and I guess we're arguing facts, but if you're in a mechanical room and you suddenly see this pile of rags start to kind of smoke with no obvious evidence of an ignition, I could see how Ms. Krause could be very confused as to what's going on. And again, thereafter, she went and got a towel and tried to put the fire out and only stopped after it was evident that the fire could not be contained.
Your time's up, Mr.
Nichols. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Giemeier, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. This is an arson case, and the main issue here is whether there is sufficient evidence in the record to sustain the defendant's arson conviction. And when the trial court's findings and the evidence in the record is reviewed in a light most favorable to the verdict, there is more than sufficient evidence to sustain the trial court's decision. In this case, the state had to prove two elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First is that defendant started the fire. And the second is that defendant did so with the intent to damage any property, including her own, to collect insurance for such loss. As to the first element of whether defendant started the fire, the evidence in the record shows is Exhibit 15, which is a security camera video capturing the defendant's movements leading up to and after the start of the fire. And in this video, the defendant carried a rectangular object, which was described by the circuit court as approximately the size of a kitchen matchbox. She then enters into the mechanical room of the basement, where the circuit court found that the fire originated. And just a couple of minutes after the defendant walked into that room, smoke begins filtering out of the mechanical room, which is visible on the video. Defendant then exits the mechanical room and turns around and for 20 seconds stares back into the mechanical room, the smoke still rolling out over her head. She then begins to walk slowly towards the stairs. And after that, and when she gets about halfway to the stairs, she turns around and re-enters the mechanical room two more times before finally going up the stairs. Also in this case, there were four experts that testified at trial, three for the state and one for the defense. And together, these experts ruled out many common potential causes of the fire, including an electrical cause of the fire, as well as a mechanical cause of the fire. And in fact, this case came down to the circuit court accepting the state's theory of how the fire started, that it was an incendiary fire started by the defendant. In doing so, the court explicitly rejected the defense's theory of how the fire started, which was that it was a stain rag fire started by spontaneous combustion. And in its findings, the circuit court also rejected the opinion of the defendant's expert on multiple grounds. And at trial, two of the state's experts testified that the fire in this case was wholly inconsistent with a spontaneous combustion fire. And they testified that a spontaneous combustion fire started by stain rags is usually a very dirty fire, one that will smoke for a long period of time, and even can smoke for up to hours before an actual flame is seen. And further, Jeff Blomseth, the State Farm investigator, testified that the concrete floor of the mechanical room would have acted as a sort of heat sink, drying heat out of the pile of debris and further lessening the chance of a spontaneous combustion fire. And when you look at that testimony with the video evidence showing how rapidly the smoke increases as it rolls out of the mechanical room, as well as the defendant's own statement she told the different investigators throughout the procession of this case, this fire developed very rapidly and does not match up with a spontaneous combustion fire. And the record contains more than sufficient evidence to show that the defendant did indeed start the fire. The second element was that the state had to prove was that the defendant had to intend to do so with the intent to damage her property to collect insurance for the loss. And for intent, we go right back to the video. As defendant exits the room, the circuit court described of the scene, the defendant's pace and body language suggested an absence of panic. And watching the video wholly supports this. The defendant stood in the doorway for 20 seconds, watching what the circuit court described as an obviously growing fire. She stood there doing nothing. She wasn't trying to do anything to suppress the fire during that time. And she wasn't not calling 911 during that time.
Just the way we review the video evidence differ, because the circuit court judge isn't in any greater position to look at the video and draw inferences than we are. We can look at the same video and have. So is that an exception to our normal standard that would contemplate deference?
Thank you, Justice Salter. I would say no, because in this case, the trial court was the finder of fact. It listened to the testimony associated with the video and thus was still in the best position to make those inferences about the video.
Counsel, would you address your opposing counsel's argument regarding what she did after the fire and whether or not it establishes there's enough evidence in the record to establish her specific intent? Namely, she filed a claim, but the claim itself, what she requested apparently isn't in the record.
So although the claim itself is not in the record, the fact that she was insured through State Farm as well as filed the claim for the insurance was in the record and was found and was noted by the circuit court in this matter. And that under the statute would be enough to show her intent to indeed collect the insurance proceeds in this matter. And by itself, that might not establish the intent, but when all of the intent evidence is looked at together, when that submission of the insurance claim is looked at in conjunction with the video, in conjunction with how defendant acted, her absence of panic after the fire, it goes to show her specific intent to damage her property and collect insurance for it. In addition, the night of the fire, when the defendant finally gets done going back into the mechanical room, she does go upstairs. And when she got upstairs, the defendant's boyfriend testified that she did not appear concerned about the fire, that she even joked about it and compared it to a time she burnt popcorn. On the day of the fire, as was alluded to earlier, water had leaked into the defendant's theater room in the basement. And the defendant's boyfriend again testified about that she wasn't concerned about this water leaking into the theater room, and that she had told him to stop working to try to get the water out of that room in the afternoon. And finally, with that, the night of the fire, the defendant's purse, laptop, and her contacts were not in her house. They were out in her car. So not only is there sufficient evidence to show the defendant's intent to start this fire, she also had the motive to do so. Defendant was a former insurance agent, so she knew how roughly how insurance claims worked. The defendant's home, as mentioned, was valued at over $1 million. It was a home she was trying to sell, and a home she was sinking a lot of money to renovate in preparation to sell it. With that, this home also had a lot of problems. As defense counsel mentioned, there was a home inspection report beforehand, and this report showed, among other things, that there was an active rodent infestation in the attic, and that there had been two recent leaks on the main floor of the house, amongst other problems. The problems that would require professionals to look at and potentially fix. And further, regarding defendant's finances at this point, yes, it is true that she had over $100,000 for income in the 3 months leading up to the fire, but on the day of the fire, she only had $16,000 left, with the home still to sell, with the renovation project still ongoing, and with the problems in the home inspection report still to be addressed. In this case, the evidence is not only sufficient enough to sustain the trial to find that the defendant intended to start this fire to collect insurance, she also had the financial motive to do so. And finally, I would like to address the defendant's argument that the State Farm's investigation violated the defendant's right to a fair trial, amongst her other constitutional rights. It has been held by this court that no constitutional violation is said to have occurred without state action. And simply put, during State Farm's investigation, there was no state action that would have implicated any of defendant's constitutional rights. The city fire investigator had finished his investigation up before State Farm and Jeff Blomseth began theirs, and the state was not involved at all with State Farm's investigation while they were investigating the house. The state only became involved after the home security camera video was discovered on Blomseth's second trip to the house. And after that, Blomseth and State Farm followed the law and turned their investigation over to the proper authorities at that point. And there is nothing in the record to suggest that State Farm's investigation was being done to look for criminal activity in this matter. Well, thus, the defendant's constitutional rights would not be implicated here. And finally, there was nothing unfair about State Farm's investigation. Tyler Tiersma, the city fire investigator, left the cause of the fire as undetermined in his report. In addition, he estimated the total damage to defendant's house to be over $300,000. Now, it was just a prudent business decision by State Farm in this matter to want to further investigate this fire, want to further investigate the cause of the fire, as well as what happened before paying out what could have been a potential six-figure insurance check. And finally, in turning their investigation over to the fire department in the state, State Farm was simply following the law. SDCL 3432A2 dictates that insurance companies who are investigating a fire and believe the fire to have started from something due to other than accidental cause to notify the proper agency, which was done in this case after the video was seen. And also the statute requires the relevant parts of the insurance company's investigation to be turned over to the proper authorities, which again is what happened in this matter. And finally, I would just ask this court to rewatch the video in Exhibit 15 from timestamp 3130 until the very end. Note the defendant's movements here. Note how she's carrying the rectangular object described by the circuit court as the size of a kitchen matchbox. How she walks into the room where the evidence determined the fire started. And how just 2 to 3 minutes after that, smoke begins coming out of that room. Rapid smoke begins filtering out of the room. And when defendant comes out of the room, her first action is to turn around and stare back through the doorway for an additional 20 seconds while she's not getting help, while she's not trying to suppress the fire. She's just standing there watching what is obviously a growing fire.
And okay, Mark, can I interrupt and redirect to one other issue? Forgive me for this. But before your time is over, I wondered if you could explain how you see the 23A.18.3 statute in this case, which is the sort of the corresponding 23C federal rule in this case, because we have some specific findings from the court acting as the fact finder, although it doesn't appear that anyone asked for them.
Mm-hmm.
If the court makes some findings on some of the elements, is the court obligated under that rule or any other rule to make an exhaustive set of findings that cover all of the elements?
That's a good question, Justice Salter. And no, in this case, the court was not required to make extensive findings in this matter. And the findings the court did make merely provided a window for this court on review to look at why the trial court came up with the verdict that it did. Because the trial court in its findings gave weight to several key pieces of evidence, like the insurance claim, like the security system video, as well as resolved the conflicting testimony between the state's experts and the defendant's experts in this case.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to the video, the defendant then walks back into the room two more times, again, delaying, trying to get help, delaying, calling 911. And as the circuit court mentioned of this, the defendant's pace and body language here suggested an absence of panic. And why was the defendant not panicking in this situation? Because she started this fire. And if there are no other questions, the state would respectfully ask this court to affirm the defendant's conviction in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Gamer.
Thank you.
Mr. Nichols, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you. Justice Salter, to address your questions with respect to the video, exhibits 14 and 15, this is de novo review. We cited the State v. Quist case that also would support the proposition that this court can and should review the video. I believe there's other Supreme Court cases that said that documentary evidence, even in clear and convincing cases, can be viewed de novo by this court. And I would submit that this court can and should review that video.
Counsel, I'd be interested in your response to the circuit court's determination that the video shows an absence of panic or alarm by the defendant.
Well, again, you have to look at that in the totality of the circumstances, and that is that she later on was trying to suppress the fire. The testimony from her boyfriend was that she viewed it similar to a popcorn fire. Earlier, she's seeing just smoke. At that point in time, it looked like something that could have been manageable. The courts are not psychologists or necessarily experts in human behavior. As this court well knows, people sometimes act very differently under different circumstances. All I can tell you is in the totality of the circumstances, she did try and suppress the fire and was physically removed from the house 10 minutes later with no shoes on in the middle of winter. Her cats died, Tony and Pepper. And in addition to that, all of the mementos of her kids also burned up in that home. And so I think we can look at that 20 seconds and make of it what we will, but you have to consider it as a total package as to what happened during the entire time. We had, Justice Salter, you had asked about the Rule 23 issue. I did speak very briefly to the Nicolite case. In that case, this court was very clear that if the trial court makes a decision that these are my factual findings on what I base my decision, that is the facts of which this court must decide the case on. And
we've held that you can't, in those instances, they're kind of the die's cast on those. We can't reconfigure those facts. But I don't know that the additional step is as clear in our cases, which is to say, I don't know that the court's obligated to make additional findings or that the court's findings, insofar as they go, have to constitute the totality of the findings and that there can be no other review of the record as a whole. I don't know about that second part.
Well, but I think it's the Nicolette case that's exactly what happened. The magistrate judge said, these are the facts on which I base the operation and control and DWI conviction. And Judge Bjorkman said, well, yeah, these are inconsistent with the state's own theory, but I think I can look generally at the record to conclude that, you know, the officer's testimony supports the conviction. And so therefore their physical custody.
So if that argument's right, though, forgive me again. So if that argument's right, then our operation of the rule would be, and our interpretation of the rule, except your argument would be that even though neither party asks or requests for specific findings in a court trial, if the court makes even one specific finding, the court, in order to achieve, you know, the result is a conviction, but in order to achieve that result, the court is obligated now on its own, having made one discrete finding, to make an exhaustive list of findings. That would be the rule. Would you agree?
That's the rule. But the statute gives the choice to the judge to whether they want to issue a general verdict or on the request of counsel, enter specific facts. It doesn't require the court to do that. There was no request in this case. The court did it sua sponte, as was the case in Nicolette. And I know
from counsel, when you say that's the rule, are you referring only to the Nicolette decision? Because the statute doesn't say what you just said.
So the statute says that the court can enter a general finding or upon request from counsel issue specific findings.
And we have no request from counsel here.
In this case. So the court went ahead and issued the findings, as was the case in Nicolette. And what the court, this court said in Nicolette is, and I'm just quoting Justice Wilbur in her concurrence and dissent, "I agree with the majority's opinion's conclusion that appellate review of the facts is limited in this case." And if you read the case in whole, what this court had held is that you were limited to the facts as found by the trial court, or I guess the magistrate court, because the magistrate court had went out of its way sua sponte to issue those facts. And well, in this particular case,
when you say limited to those facts, the court was referring to a specific contrary fact made by the circuit court that would have been inconsistent with the magistrate court's findings. And the court said, unless the reviewing court finds that to be clearly erroneous, the court cannot then rely or upon an inconsistent fact or determination.
You're right, but the Nicolette court did not find Judge Kiner, I think, magistrate judge's facts clearly erroneous. They just said Judge Bjorkman erred in reaching to other facts outside of Judge Kiner's facts to determine whether a DWI had occurred. And I think that's exactly what we're requesting here. You have an essential element of the crime, the intent to commit insurance fraud, which is not embraced in the trial court's specific findings. And if that statute is to mean something and Nicolette is to mean something, then I think the court is limited to the fact that he did not make a finding of intent to collect insurance. And so we had asserted that that is the grounds for error in this case, and that issue alone should be grounds for reversal.
Nicolette was similar to this case in some ways. I mean, just sort of the way it's set up, because when we indicated that in our opinion, there's, you know, physical control is really the only issue. And of course, there's other elements of DWI.
Sure.
But physical control was the principal issue. Seems like that's kind of like what's going on in this case. There's other elements, but the principal element was the origin of the fire, right? And so could you read Nicolette, I think it's just Spaney might be suggesting, to simply allow for deference to those findings that the court made insofar as they made them, not deviate from them, or at least, you know, treat them with deference unless they're clearly erroneous. And examine that in the light of what was appeared to be the most controverted factual issue before the court, but otherwise have freedom to examine the totality of the record to determine if there's enough evidence on the other elements.
Well, and why the court didn't do this in Nicolette is in paragraph 14, it said when the magistrate made his findings, those findings were specific and they resolved conflicting testimony of a nature of control. And in this particular case, the judge went out of his way to make a number of findings, much more robust than was the case in Nicolette, including choosing which experts he found credible and which ones he did not. And in doing so, failed to address any facts as to an essential element of the crime.
But counsel, what are you suggesting the remedy would be if that were, in fact, the rule that we apply here? Because, you know, in cases where that has happened and this was a court trial, wouldn't the remedy simply be to remand it back to the court to then enter a specific finding on the whether or not there was specific intent?
Well, and I think in civil cases, that has been what this court has done. We cited a Tenth Circuit case where there was a central element that was missing. It's a Milton case in our reply brief. And in that case, it was a reversal, I believe. And just the record before the court, there were specific findings. And as was the case in Nicolite, it was reversed. And so I think that case is very apropos here. And I think that's the result.
So you're suggesting a new trial versus a remand for findings?
With Nicolite, it's reversed, yes. So that would be the what we're suggesting. I've covered a lot of ground. I apologize.
Can I ask you a question while you kind of regroup? What specifically do you think the constitutional nature of whatever rights may be implicated is that you've suggested in your third issue? And I'll give you just a little bit more to kind of give you an idea of where my head's at. I'm not sure. So let's say even if the State Farm investigator were a state actor, and I'm not suggesting that he was, it doesn't seem as though, I mean, what should he have done? What more by way of rights, individual rights that your client would have liked to asserted, wasn't she able to assert? Did you make any effort to exclude any evidence prior to the trial based upon some sort of a exclusionary principle? Anything along those lines?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think and I thought a lot about it. It's the case as a whole is what became fundamentally unfair. And it's not like one specific issue. It's just the entire unfairness. I give you an example of the matchbox. Okay, where did the matchbox come from? The whole idea that there was a matchbox in this house came from Ms. Krause giving her recount to Blumseth as to what happened. And so there's no procedural protections here. And so that's the only
procedural protection would there be?
Right against self-incrimination, a whole host of them. We have chain of custody
issues. But of
course
she wasn't. I mean, is there any evidence she was in custody? I mean, even if he was a police officer, would he have been obligated to give her Miranda warnings if, you know, she's not in custody?
May I continue?
Yeah, you can answer the question.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize we were getting that. Oh, forgive me.
Well, I think, again, you got to look at the totality of the circumstances, because, I mean, that's just one of the issues. But you also have a spoliation issue or a chain of custody issue with this video, right? So the video cuts off miraculously immediately after we have this scene staring in the closet and we don't know what happened to the other 10 minutes. And so, you know, if you're in the context of a criminal investigation, you know, it's a very different thing. In this particular case, there wasn't any kind of a search warrant, to my knowledge, in the record or any investigation by law enforcement. So you have basically the investigation conducted as an arm of the state without the safeguards that you would have. All the discovery, again, you know, we got no discovery from the state because the state had nothing other than what State Farm had furnished. And so that's why I believe that Kansas case, that arm of the state argument, there isn't one specific thing we can just say, yeah, that's the fundamental flaw here. It's the case as a whole. It looks nothing like you would expect of a criminal case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. I want to thank counsel for your arguments and briefing in the case. And that will conclude the court session for the April term here at the South Dakota School of Mines. Before we close the record, I again want to thank the South Dakota School of Mines and President Rankin for their hosting the court here this week. I know there's a number of staff here at the college that have assisted, and particularly want to name Jade Herman and thank her for the work that she's put in to really make this a successful week for the court. I also want to thank campus security, South Dakota Highway Patrol, who has assisted us with security this week, Greg Satizan, who I know gave opening introductions every day to a little bit of the work of the court. And finally, our clerk of court, Shirley Jamison Fergal, for all of her work. She does. She doesn't just sit at that desk. She does a lot of work behind the scenes that most of you don't see in order for this to take place. And so I want to make sure that we appreciate her this morning as well. With that, we will conclude our session, and thank you for your attendance.